Thank you all so much for being here. We've got Sarah, James, and Ali here for an important conversation, political polarization, the state of the news media, handful of journalists up here, and I'd love to begin with a conversation. James, I'll kick things off with you. We'll go right down. And I want to get a sense, obviously, at least at home in the United States, but probably around the world for international politics. We've certainly had times in history where we've had division, but it really seems like something has changed here in our lifetimes in the last decade. James, I wonder if there is a moment that you look back at, specifically in the last 10 years, that really defines the current era of divisiveness in our politics.
I honestly think actually it's got real causes rather than culture war causes, and that's why it's across the world and across cultures. The settlement hasn't worked since about 2008. Wages stopped increasing, quality of life stopped getting better. People look at sort of adults under 40 in a lot of countries are paying more in rent, they can't buy homes, they can't look at that. And so you get disaffected when you do everything right and you don't get the deal. And the difficulty is, I think the media still looks and sounds a little bit too much like the political class that's being blamed for this failure. So I think we tend to point at the media or point at Trump or point at these things that are symptoms. But I think there's quite a fundamental problem at the core of it, which is that no mainstream sort of government has really got a handle on how to get living standards going up again, how to get homes being affordable, how to sort of make it feel like the next generation will be better off than this one. I think that's the big cause, and you're not going to fix that with, you know, a nice fake news banner.
Probably not. Sarah, what stands out to you in terms of this era of polarization? You're in from Washington, D.C. You see this front and center perhaps more than anyone else.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with what James has to say. I feel like in the U.S. at least, I think it's been a slow boil, kind of like the frog in the pot situation. That's not something that happened with Trump coming to office, but something that started quite well before that, that certainly got accelerated. And I don't see that easing up any bit. And I think you could have this argument about, is it the chicken and the egg? What role does the media have in reflecting, you know, people's partisan divides, or is that reflected back in the media that people choose because they want to be affirmed by what they read or have their beliefs confirmed by what they read? And certainly, I would say, like, the news business hasn't helped that, for sure. I think there are a lot of incentives that got a lot, especially in digital, like, and other, I'll actually broadcast, name one, that fed into that. They saw a business market in that and catering to more partisan audiences, and that's, I think, what's new, at least from American media, that's perhaps a little different.
Ali, I wonder from your perspective specifically if there's something international media you see that those of us who come from Washington, D.C. and New York might skip as we focus so heavily on U.S. politics.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, as a U.S. educated German citizen of Turkish descent, I sort of have a triple perspective on this issue. But I would perhaps contest the notion that these are extraordinarily toxic times, indeed. I mean, I'm old enough, I lived in Washington, I was a student at Georgetown University when the whole Monica Lewinsky scandal broke. I mean, the only difference today is back then social media didn't play that big of a role, it just wasn't present yet, or rather in its early stages.
Can you imagine Twitter during that era?
Twitter during the Monica Lewinsky episode, that would have been interesting. But I mean, look, I mean, we talk about Trump and all that, and clearly he's not helping the cause. But again, I remember the election of George W. Bush with the help of his brother, Jeb Bush, who was a governor in Florida back then. Many people contest that was a stolen election back then. So what I'm trying to say is I'm trying to put things in perspective sometimes. Sometimes we journalists also, we also perpetuate things by suggesting that these are extraordinarily toxic times. But honestly, especially as a German journalist, when I look at YouTube, at German parliamentary debates in the 70s and 80s, they were much more heated than the semi-love fest that I'm seeing these days, much more tame. Of course, US is a different story, but I think it's really the social media aspect, and that everybody is willing and able to chime in any given day on any given subject matter, amplifies the so-called toxic environment that we're supposed to live in.
And it's great that we're doing this conversation with journalists. When I was a White House reporter for years, I felt myself defending the Fourth Estate to friends and family who were understandably very critical of what we did. I had family members from Brooklyn who were who would call me to my face, "Well, you're basically fake news. You're a reporter at the White House. You cover Trump. You're not fair." And I felt myself being at times so red in the face defending the work that I and my colleagues did at the White House or on Capitol Hill. And an open question for all of you, I wonder what you attribute the decline in trust in news media too, because Pew Research and other polls continues to show that that decline in trust has started long ago, and it simply continues. That's to anyone. Yeah.
I mean, I think there's a declining trust in all institutions, so it's not surprising the media is part of that, or top of the list where that can start. But I think we are in a cycle that has led to a lot more distrust in that feeds into itself. So you talk about social media. I'm talking about like news media being more fragmented. There's so many layers of reasons why I think that has happened. I think what's different today than, say, a George W. Bush administration that I covered back in the day is that there used to be a line where politicians, regardless of party, would say, "This is too far. We don't cross this line." They would back each other up. You know, if you had something like a Nancy Pelosi attack on her husband, the elevation to violence, that would be an obvious line that we don't advocate or cross. And in fact, we say we stop, calm down. I think there's just no lever anymore to stop that, unfortunately, or it's very rare.
I agree with pretty much everything there. And actually, it's been interesting. A few US commentators have noted with Liz Truss's recent prime ministership, which was so successful she could end after 45 days. They went, actually, it's nice to see Britain still has a floor. Her approval dropped to 6%, and that couldn't happen to Trump because of the poll. They were saying, oh, for all that it's insane over there, they still have that. But I think there's a broad thing on. Societies are still at different levels, but almost every society is less deferential than it was 30 years and 60 years ago. And part of that is they see too much of us now. You know, the BBC newsreader used to have an incredibly posh clipped accent and tell you the news from on high like the voice of God. You know, people see BBC news, people do skits on Twitter and get things wrong and make silly jokes to each other. I think that's good. I think that's humanizing. But you can't still do the voice of God. And I think the media too often tries to go, hello, come to us, elevated purveyors of the facts, which we hand down to you every day, the little person. And we haven't, not enough places have got used to the new voice of, we're trying to find all this out, you want to know it, here's our best effort today, if it changes, we'll come back tomorrow. And I think we have to move from authority to authenticity to do that. And I don't think it's a comfortable shift that we've managed yet.
Well, JD, to be quite honest, I mean, sometimes I wish, as a trained journalist for over two decades, that our profession would be a bit more self-critical and self-examine itself a bit more. What I mean by that is, too often I see colleagues, journalists, not reporting the story, but trying to be part of the story. That is something, to be quite honest, and I may be old-fashioned when I studied journalism at Columbia School over 20 years ago. That's certainly not how it was taught to me. It was stick to the facts. And now I read a new story, and within one or two sentences, I know where the story is going. Sometimes I know who writes it. I don't even have to click on the story. I know what the perspective will be of that person. So, a lot of journalists are trying to be, maybe that's a provocative word, a celebrity these days. They're trying to be on Twitter. They're trying to hash it out and get into Twitter battles with the president of the United States. And I'm like, what the hell is going on here? You know, it's so in my opinion, and this is the genie may be out of the box, Pandora's box has been opened, so this is semi-old man pleading for the old ways of doing it. But I wish that I worked with legends like Peter Jennings at ABC News. back in the day. I didn't know where you were standing politically. Mm-hmm. And now you know where everybody's standing. You know where Anderson Cooper is standing. You know certainly where Tucker Carlson is standing.
Well,
but who?
I said sure.
Yeah, sure. This may be wishful thinking,
sure,
because journalists are now part of the debate,
right,
deliberately so.
Right.
I happen to be one who bemoaned that fact.
Sure. Now, let me challenge you here, because we may have some people who sit here and said, we just had a president of the United States, and I covered him as a reporter, and I don't mind saying, this man lied as if it were a professional sport. And oftentimes you have a person who tells you that red is not red, 2 + 2 doesn't equal 4, and he says it with a straight face, and he has convinced millions of Americans back home that his alternative realities are true. What are the pressures of a newsroom then to contextualize and said, sure, maybe we did cover the era of the Cheneys and the Bushes. Do new rules need to apply if our world leaders are weaponizing truth in a way that we just haven't seen at the highest levels?
I think our answer to that, and I don't know if everyone's familiar with Axios, we're only a 5-year-old news organization, but what we try to do is double down on being transparent about what we do and how we do it. And that means being transparent about, like, we don't do opinion. We don't, like, our journalists are not there to tell you their opinion on Twitter or in any news story. We try to just remain very clinical about how we report and make sure that we have an audience for all people of all political stripes. So what does that mean? That means that when you have a president who's lying or administration, whatever the administration is, we're really clear about what is correct and what is incorrect. But we're not to the point of like taking sides. Like we're not taking political sides. We have to have really good sources with all, you know, politicians of all stripes. And we have to be able to ensure that we can like do journalism that is trusted by people of all parties. That is increasingly difficult, but I think we found that in a short period of time we've been able to do that. We, you know, started in the Trump administration and continuing into the Biden administration. Who knows what's going to happen in 2 years? Who knows what's going to happen on Tuesday? But I think that, you know, that is a rare thing to have, and it starts with being really clear about what we do and how we do it.
Sure, and I'd like to clarify, of course, all presidents lie. Every White House lies. Every member of Congress lies. And there's different reasons as to why. This is not just an issue with the former President Trump. I want to be clear. So, I think that's a great point Sarah brought up.
I sort of, one thing that's changed is politicians and governments and corporations even are a lot more savvy at manipulating the norms of the media than they used to be. And the media is catching up slowly and often actually sort of doing the wrong things, I think. And this isn't particular outlets, but rather than think about, say, Trump or someone, I sort of think about Russia, and I think about wire services. And wire services for a long time have been established on, if someone says something, you have someone in the room, you put out accurately what they said quickly. And in the sort of, you know, the before times, that only went into newsrooms who the theory would then sift it, put it in its proper context, etc. Wires make it to the public now. And so Russia is very sophisticated at having someone say something and it goes out on a wire, unmediated, before several hours later it's put into context and explained and sorted. And they use that to great advantage to spread narratives, often false narratives, in Ukraine. They use it to mess with other democracies. To different extents, politicians play on that too. And so the issue is, you as an individual outlet can make the decision to contextualize and not be first and not, you know, the old thing of if a politician says it's raining and another says it's not your job to report the row, it's your job to put your hand out the window. You know, that's easy to say, but while you're doing that, someone else has just got 100 retweets for Trump says it's raining.
Sure.
And so what we regard as responsible, what we regard as good journalism, has to change, and we don't have that consensus yet.
If we're talking about lies, you know, I mean, at the end of the day, I revert back to George W. Bush, you know, who based an entire war against two countries on a lie with hundreds of thousands of people having died. And as a result and as a reward, he got reelected the last time I checked. So, yes, unfortunately, what you're saying. I think this is one of the, and being on the stage at Fourth Estate, no better venue, this is one of the best professions out there, being a journalist, truly. There's a reason why this journalism and the profession, the responsibilities of those professions is enshrined in every single democratic constitution, because it is so important for us to keep the responsible people on the edge and keep their feet to the fire. But my worry and my concern is coming back to us trying to be part, being a player rather than controlling
the player.
You know, I think something's got lost here throughout the years, where the overall public, thus the decline of trust in us, in journalists, in the media, are viewing us as part of the elite. We are part of the elite who are in the backstage, hashing out with corporate companies and with politicians, and that is extremely, extremely detrimental. Because if anything, and again, this may be very naive to think, we have to stay above this fray. Otherwise, how are we supposed to critically cover these people if we're constantly having lunch, having lunch with these people in D.C. and schmoozing at these gala dinners and so on and so forth, you know? I think it's a problem. I think it's a problem. If we journalists do not understand ourselves as somebody who are advocates of publics like these, who are watching us right now, we are supposed to expose the lies and the lack of truth, whatever you want to call it, of the people who are governing us.
Yeah.
And more often, we are power drunk. We are power drunk rather than doing our job, but that is just my humble observation.
No, it's a great call, and I'm kind of glad you call out, because unfortunately that is the way. More oftentimes it can work in Washington, D.C. You go to parties, you see people there that you just interviewed on national television or someone, and part of that networking is, for good or for bad, oftentimes it can be part of the way the game is played. I do want to pivot to social media, because we've started to get into that a little bit. TikTok users, we got TikTok fans in the crowd. Show of hands. Yes, a few. I think everyone's on TikTok. You just don't want to admit it. We were talking about this in an email chain, and I want to get your takes about what it says. First of all, TikTok is the world's number one domain. And in terms of news, if people want to know what's going on with an issue they've heard about, they're probably opening up the TikTok app. They're typing in the topic, and they're watching the most viral take. The person who delivers that news is likely not a journalist, likely doesn't have the backgrounds that you all have. And I wonder what it says to you that in today's day and age, the most viral content on a news story may not be accurate because it's user-generated content on TikTok, as opposed to the really hard-fought reporting that incredible, intrepid journalists are doing throughout the world that may not end up getting the same traction as a viral video on TikTok.
This is what happens when you abandon audiences.
Abandon
audiences.
Abandon audience.
Newsrooms kind of went, young people don't like news, you know, screw them, we'll carry on with the people who are easy to reach because they must be the people who are interested. Right. And then TikTok shows that actually, if you change the delivery and the format, people do care about issues. And then you go, well, this is bad because the young people are getting the wrong news. You know, we are the only industry that keeps going, hey, you know, we make our products, people don't buy it, those people are wrong and must be educated. You know, if you're a restaurant and you make crappy food, you don't go, well, the diners are wrong, you change your menu. And we have a real habit of going, we must deliver the same slop and they must eat it, you know? If you look at that, we should be looking at the potential and going, how do you get proper, good news hooks on it? I personally really like the Washington Post TikTok, for example. Right. That might be a bad sign because I'm older than TikTok's demo. But, you know, I think a lot of the alternative media, which, you know, in the UK tended to be hard left, that arose because mainstream media didn't take Corbynism seriously. And a lot of it was awful, but it arose because the mainstream failed. I think a lot of the alt-right stuff in the US is the same. It's very complex there, but there's no one speaking to them. For young people on TikTok, we abandoned the field and then get cross someone else is in it.
Yeah.
I guess for us, I guess I feel a little bit old school, but I've seen so many different social media platforms come and go. I'm very interested to see what happens with TikTok. It's underdeveloped in terms of being a revenue source or building a sense of audience for the long term, but it's still a baby. So I'm interested to see where that goes. And I think for us at Axios, we have a slightly different demographic. We're really reaching a lot of, trying to reach a lot of people in this room with our newsletters. And we want to reach smart professionals. We want to help them understand news that's relevant to them and their industry, whether that's politics or tech or business or markets, whatever it is. So we're not quite for the TikTok audience yet, but doesn't mean we're not thinking about it. I definitely think, just for like my own kids, who are the oldest is a teenager now, like, you know, like obviously they consume information on video primarily. That is how they absorb it. That is what sticks in their mind. It's imprinted in their memory, and the world is open to them in terms of who has authority, right? So that seems like an opportunity for sure, but it hasn't been something I've been eager to run through. I think that, you know, pivot to video has burned some of us in the past, and so I'm curious to see how that develops.
The pivot to video, that yeah. phrase itself is a joke on political Twitter.
It's a very cruel thing to say to someone who used to work at BuzzFeed.
We've all had the pivots to videos.
I needed a trigger warning.
And by the way, if I can interrupt quickly, if you're not familiar with the Axios newsletter, smart brevity is largely what they try and go after, and They are incredible. They're must reads, especially if you're into politics, news, tech. So you didn't pay me to plug there. I'm just a big fan of Axios. But I do want to get your perspective here as well about the rise of social media.
No, I mean, I see that time is winding down. I mean, the only thing I would say, as I see in my personal surrounding, personal environment, friends, family members who are just tuning out. They're not watching any news anymore. They just can't take it anymore. The incessant negativity that is coming their way. I mean, looking at this audience, how many people here have tuned out of news? just don't follow news anymore to protect their mental health or whatever it is. You know,
I wish I could sometimes, honestly.
You know, I mean, it's not our job. It's not our job to make the world better than it is, but it's also not our job to make it worse than it is. And clickbaiting is part of the job, and the drastic headlines, some things that we produce. The world is with war, with the high living costs, inflation, energy crisis, you name it. Times are tough, but at the same time, I worry that so many people, JD, are just not following our work anymore. They're just not following out either because they think we're partial, we're not impartial, that's one thing, we're not trustworthy, or they just think, you know, at the end of the day, it is just, it's too negative of a burden on their mental health. I don't have the solution yet.
You know, it's a great conversation when the four of us could easily do this for another hour. Unfortunately, I'm sure you want us here for another hour too. Unfortunately, you need to wrap it. There we go. Let's get an applause here for James, Sarah, and Ali one more time. Thank you all so much for taking the time. Thank you. Enjoy your time in Lisbon.